The scene shifts to Madison Square Garden, and coming up on the Rami LaVie podcast, we talk about it, both for the Rangers and for the Knicks. They're headed home Friday night basketball on MSG at MSG for the New York Knicks. That series is tied 1-1 after a blowout loss to the Cavaliers in Game 2. The Knicks will try and get back on the upper hand of the series. We talked about that. We talked about what went wrong in Game 2 in Cleveland and how the Knicks can fix those things in Game 3. We also talked about the first two games at The Rock for the Rangers and what was a dominant performance for the Rangers in the first two games. How can they keep that going? What can the Devils do to get themselves back into the series? And we also talked about the rest of the National Basketball Association, the NBA playoffs. All that and a whole lot more coming up next on the Rami LaVie podcast. Stay tuned. One of the things I talk about on this podcast a lot is the stigma against mental health. I think, unfortunately, there has been a stigma, but we're slowly breaking it. And if you think you might be feeling depressed, stressed, anxious, overwhelmed, or maybe you just want to talk to someone, today's sponsor, BetterHelp, is here to help you. BetterHelp offers licensed therapists who are trained to listen and help. Talk to your therapist in a private online environment at your convenience. There's a broad range of expertise in BetterHelp's 20,000 plus therapist network that may not be available in your area. You just fill out a questionnaire to help access your specific needs, and then you get matched with a therapist in another 48 hours. Plus, you can exchange unlimited text messages, and everything you share is completely confidential. So I talk about on this podcast how your mindset towards things changes everything. One of the things that I learned in therapy was that join the 2 million plus people who have taken charge of their mental health with an experienced BetterHelp therapist. Get 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/Rami. That's my first name. That's BetterHelp, BetterHelp.com/Rami, my first name, Rami. If you use that link, the link is in the description in the podcast notes. If you use that link, you'll get 10% off and it'll also help me out. So please do that. I'm telling you, it's worth it. Do it today. Welcome back to the Rami LaVie podcast, episode 143. Great to have you here listening. Appreciate it, as always. Anyone who listens, shares it, all that stuff. I do want to end or start where I ended last episode, a bunch of stuff. I listened back to it. It sounded like a little bit of a downer. It was not. It was a positive thing. But if you haven't listened back to the end of last episode, it was just kind of some real stuff. And what I wanted to say was anyone can be, you know, that stuff happens not in this industry only, but it's not exclusive to me or this industry or anything like that. So, you know, you go through certain times, or even if it's not in a job, whatever it is, that you're up or you're down and you're thinking about certain things a little bit differently and you're trying to figure out what the next step is and if the last step you made was a misstep or, you know, where to go from where you are. And you always have to remind yourself things sometimes take time and things develop in their own way, and that's okay. And not to make that sound like a negative, because it was not. Everything so far has been like a huge positive, and Major League Baseball is super cool and everything is looking up. And there's some other really cool things in the works. I just thought they'd be done faster. And so right now is the waiting game, and that's part of life. As Dr. Seuss says, and oh, the places you'll go. He talks about, I don't know if is Dr. Seuss canceled, but in that book, he talks about the waiting game and playing around, waiting for things to happen. So sometimes that happens as well. And that's okay. All right, let's shift gears. Let's talk about something else. Let's talk about sports. Let's talk about what we usually do here, which is sports. And I wanted to start, I did mention my two favorite teams who play in the winter and in Madison Square Garden are in the playoffs in the first round. I talked about game one of the Knicks series. We'll talk about game two on this episode. We'll also talk about the first two games of the Rangers series. I did not do a preview, but it's funny because somebody actually asked me what I thought the keys to the series were for the Rangers, and I sent him a whole long DM on Instagram, so I'll read some of what I wrote there because it's kind of interesting how it's played out for the Rangers and the Devils in that series. We do have some NBA other topics to hit in the first round, so we'll get into all of it as Madison Square Garden is going to be on fire tonight. Today's Friday. It's the 21st. And so tonight, Madison Square Garden is going to be on fire as the Knicks are at home against the Cleveland Cavaliers for Game 3 with the series tied at 1. Two crazy first games, and we'll get into it right now. So, and then, by the way, Saturday night at the Garden, Game 3, as the Rangers have a commanding 2-0 lead. So we'll get into the Rangers a little bit later. Let's start with the Knicks. The Knicks, they lose game two after winning game one and not the most convincing win in game one. They lose game two. We know how that went. If you look at it, it was a 107-90 final, only 17 points. But the Knicks were down by almost 30 at points in this game. It was a blowout from the start, really the end of the first quarter, beginning of the second quarter is when Cleveland really began to pull away, and they didn't look back. It wasn't close at that point. So what happened in this game? Let's talk about that and what can happen in game three. What can change for the Knicks to get themselves feeling like they're back in a series, which, you know, being 1-1 coming home usually feels pretty good if you can split the first two games on the road. And for the Knicks, somehow it feels not that way because of how they lost game two. So let's talk about what happened and what can change and what positives maybe we could take out of it and see what trends we can pick up on for the rest of the series. So the number one thing, and I think this has been the biggest talking point on Knicks Twitter because it's such a big part of this team's identity. It was obviously a big part of the offseason. It was a big conversation piece for the last couple of years, and that is RJ Barrett. RJ Barrett, of course, gets drafted third overall, and you look at those picks. Ja had his off-the-court issues, but Ja's obviously a superstar. Zion Williamson, I don't know if I'd still take Zion Williamson over RJ Barrett. It's hard to make an argument that he's had a better career so far. This is the second time in four seasons that RJ Barrett is a prominent piece, a starting role on a team that's made the playoffs. But I went back and I was watching, and we'll get to this a little bit more later when we talk about another Knick, but I was watching some of the highlights from the Knicks playoffs a couple years ago just to get myself hyped up for Madison Square Garden and what that's going to be like. And I was watching the highlights from games one and two at the Garden against Atlanta. And RJ Barrett was such a big part of that offense, and he's knocking down shots in the mid-range. He's knocking down jumpers. And something happened over the second half of the season that he just can't shoot anymore. And he's always been hot and cold with shooting, but everyone said RJ Barrett, and I said this last episode, RJ Barrett has the ability to shoot you out of a game single-handedly, because if he decides I'm going to just start chucking up jumpers and they're not going, that's really bad. And right now for RJ Barrett, those shots are not going. They're not falling down. Let me just pull up the stats real quick, what he's looked like in this series. He was in game two shooting the ball. RJ Barrett was 4-for-13, 0-for-3 from 3-point range. And just to go back to game one, which they won, RJ Barrett was 2-for-12 in game one and 1-for-5 from three. So he's 1-for-8 from three in the series. And what is that? 5-for-math real quick. Doing the math, what is it, 5-for-25 shooting in the series? I don't remember the two numbers I said at this point, but yeah, 5-for-25 or 6-for-25 in the series and 1-for-8 from three. That's not good enough if you're RJ Barrett. And the problem has become, and one particular possession really stood out to me, and I wrote it down when I was watching the game, the problem has become not just scoring the ball, because one of the things that he did so well the later part of the season was when he couldn't shoot, he started getting to the rim. And by the way, they play this on WFAN, so I think I could say it without having to put a little E next to this episode. Although when I was watching this Knicks game, I was getting so frustrated. After the game, sometimes I'll drive home from, you know, and I'll send myself voice memos as I'm driving. And that'll be kind of like my notes instead of like actually writing down notes. And one of the times I was doing that, it was this week, I was like, wow, I'm so talented. Like I recall my recollection of the game and my points that I want to talk about. Like one day I'm just going to do the podcast like this without having to actually write down game notes. This is my game notes. I watched the game an hour ago and I'm now driving and just repeating everything I wanted to mention so I don't forget it for later. But anyway, where was I? One of the times when I was doing that, I was thinking like, oh, let me just rattle off a bunch of curses. Let me just like, I'm going to put that E next to it. But I'm going to keep the podcast rated, I guess, G or PG and not put that little E next to it. And what I was going to say was this line might cross that line a little bit, but somebody on a Cleveland Cavaliers, this guy works for Fox Sports Radio. I don't know his name. I remember it being a strong name, but guy hosts a Cleveland Cavaliers podcast, and they play this on WFAN, this clip. He said, RJ Barrett has the touch of a sexual predator. It's unwelcome and should be illegal. Yeah, that's not very good. But he's not wrong. RJ Barrett can't shoot right now, but the problem, like I said, is his finishing around the rim. He was doing such a good job. He was shooting in the paint. Somebody pointed this out. Tommy Beer, I think, pointed this out a while ago, where his numbers inside the paint the last couple months were incredible. He was finishing at such a high rate, and then his shooting numbers were still struggling, but he was making more of an effort. And there was one possession in particular in this game that drove me absolutely insane, where he was with the second unit. It was still a close game, and he's dribbling the ball on the outside. Dribble, dribble, dribble. He's got Sexton on him. He's got Garland on him, who's a much smaller defender, much smaller guard than him. And one of the things, Garland had such a great offensive game, which I did say in after game one that I thought that was going to happen, that Garland was going to have a great offensive game in game two. But he has such a great offensive game. Maybe you could take Garland out by, you know, wearing him down on the defensive side, kind of like Julius did with Evan Mobley on the boards in game one. And RJ starts to take him towards the rim and then spins around and spins out of the lane and shoots like this fall away baby hook jumper. What are you doing? You're much stronger than him. You're much bigger than him. Take him down low, punish him. And that's the best course of action if you're RJ Barrett. And I don't understand how you don't do that if you're RJ Barrett, how you shy away from that. And part of it is because maybe he's losing confidence because he hasn't been finishing at the rim. He hasn't been able to get those layups to go, which is a real issue. And it's getting to the point now where if he can't finish at the rim, you can't really play him. Because at this point, like you can't have him shoot you out of a game. You have to take him off. You have to figure out something else. And with the way they were defending everyone else, RJ Barrett shouldn't be dribbling the ball. If RJ Barrett is dribbling the ball on the perimeter, that's exactly what the Cavs want. And we'll talk about the defense that the Cavs played in a minute. But if they're playing that style defense that was working for them in this game, that can't be what you fall back on. If you're the Knicks, that can't be the offense you fall into. And RJ Barrett has to know better. He has to find himself a different role. I understand that RJ wants to be a big part of this team. He probably looks back at the 2021 videos also and is like, wow, it was such a major part of the offense. There weren't as many options in 2021. It's just a fact. You know, it was Derrick Rose and Julius kind of disappeared in that series. So Alec Burks and Derrick Rose were the guys in that series. So RJ did have to make some stuff happen in that series. But right now, he's not that guy, and he's been inconsistent throughout his career, and I know he wants to be that guy, and I don't think there's too much pressure on him. I think he's just putting too much pressure on himself by trying too hard to be that guy, and it's not working for him right now. Try and do other things. Play hard defense. Get the rebounds, because his defense, when the shots weren't going, the confidence fell, and obviously you see there's no confidence there because he's not backing a guy down. He's turning away from the rim and shooting a fall away. All of a sudden, it's affecting him on the other side of the floor. It's affecting him on the defensive side, and you see it clearly. And that's become a major issue for RJ as well. Other points, I mean, the only thing about RJ Barrett is his terrible shooting was hidden in the performance of the rest of the team, because the team shot 36% from the field, so nobody could shoot. And that's a huge negative, but it's also a positive for the long term, because like maybe this isn't going to happen again. But part of that was Cleveland's defense. Cleveland's defense was really good. So you could say, yeah, it's not going to happen again. They're going to shoot 35%. Maybe. But there was something very interesting that they were doing defensively. Two things that I noticed in game two that Cleveland was doing defensively. One, they were disrupting a lot of the passes the Knicks were making. A lot of the passes were coming from the perimeter, and they were just getting hands in the passing lane. You have to know, just standing still and trying to pass it to someone else is not going to work if you're the Knicks, because the length of Cleveland, we talk about this a million times with Mobley and Allen, those guys are so long that they're going to disrupt, they're going to get into the passing lanes. Even Garland was getting into the passing lanes. That will lead to fast breaks. The Knicks turned the ball over 17 times, which is extremely uncharacteristic for a team like the Knicks, who doesn't turn the ball over a lot, and a lot of it happened because they were just so stagnant and then just predictable when they pass the ball. So the way to combat that is off-ball cuts. And another thing Cleveland was doing was they were shading on Brunson. They were sending another big at Brunson. So whatever side he was on, whether it was Mobley or Allen, they're kind of sending him towards Brunson and leaving the back cuts and leaving the lanes to the rim open. So there were other lanes to the rim. You're shutting down Brunson. And it was basically, okay, Brunson can't beat us, for someone else to beat us. Someone else on the Knicks is going to have to make plays. And whether that's Quentin Grimes, who only took two shots in this game and clearly seems lost out there and hasn't found his footing yet in his first ever playoff series, I get that. Or Emmanuel Quickley, who hasn't been very good off the bench, and we'll talk about he found a little rhythm at the end of that game. They have to be working off ball, or maybe Quickley can make plays with the ball in his hands, getting the back cuts. Hartenstein was trying, where he was getting that thing where he stands up like kind of at the free throw line and he could run the offense from there a little bit, a little baby Jokic action with him. And that worked a little bit, but Randall, can he create something for you guys? Is that something you can end up relying on? I'm not sure, but if they're going to help out on Brunson, if they're going to make sure, okay, this guy can't beat us, there's going to be open lanes. There's going to be openings for other people to beat you or to beat the Cavs, but someone has to step up. I think going home is going to be a big part of that because Emmanuel Quickley, Quentin Grimes, those guys, Quickley especially, was so good at the Garden a couple years ago. Like I mentioned, I was watching those videos in 2021. Emmanuel Quickley was so good in those games at Madison Square Garden in the playoffs. I think him going home would help a lot. I did think at the end of this game, I said it was a 30-point game, and then he kind of cut into that lead. He got made a bunch of strong plays at the end of the game and kind of got into rhythm. And a lot of people are like, well, why is he still out there? Him and Julius especially. And Tibbs said those guys wanted to get into rhythm because they felt so out of sync, so out of rhythm the whole game. And I actually don't hate it for Quickley because they're going to need him to be a big part of this offense. Another thing that I think you can think about doing, I mentioned last episode that you can't go big because they have those, or you can't go small rather if you're the Knicks because they have those two bigs. But if they're going to be shading on Brunson with one of the bigs, then maybe you try and counter what they're doing with going small, with having, you know, Hart and Grimes and Quickley all on the floor at the same time with Randall and Brunson. And that way there's a lot going on. And if they're going to send a second guy, a big man, at Brunson, he won't be able to recover in time to pick up another quick, smaller guy getting to the rim, and you can get a bunch of easy shots or kick it out for three. You need to have shooting on the floor. You can't just have stagnant. And by the way, that also means that Brunson, this is going to fall on Jalen Brunson. He's going to have to understand that, okay, they're making me give up the ball. How can I find other ways? Be the point guard. Get your teammates involved. Don't just be, okay, game one, he was able to take over, go one-on-one, and win those matchups, and it didn't matter, and he was going to win every time. The way they won a game earlier this year in Cleveland without Julius Randle was Brunson had 43 points. That's not going to happen again because they've committed to shutting down Brunson. So now you got to be the team's point guard, something that he is for this team. And it's the first time the Knicks have had a point guard like this in a long time. You're going to have to figure out how to shut everyone else down. Speaking of Josh Hart, I mentioned him as one of the guys who could be on the floor. Is he hurting the team? I talked about this before the series. I didn't realize he'd be hurt. He almost didn't play in game two, but I talked about this before the series, how he could be extremely frustrating at times because he can't shoot, because his offensive skill is somewhat lacking, that if all those other little things are not up to par, the steals, the hustle plays, the rebounds, the defense, all that stuff, if that's not contributing, then he can end up hurting the team. And if he's not healthy enough, if he's hurt right now and he's not healthy enough to help the team in all those small hustle ways that he does, that could be a major detriment to what the Knicks are trying to do. So that's just a point that you should keep an eye on for game three. Game one, obviously, he was incredible. Can't take that away from them. Another thing I saw in the first quarter, the Knicks, what they did was they played really tough and they weren't hitting their shots. It's not like the first quarter they were hitting the shots. They were shooting 30% in the first quarter, maybe even lower. But they were able to hang with the Cavs even when they weren't hitting their shots. And that's something that the Knicks did all year, that even when they struggled, I was shocked that they didn't come out in the second half and come out with a strong energy, because even when they struggle, they've always had the energy up. They've always been able to hang with teams. They've rarely gotten blown out. So I think the end of the first quarter where RJ's just bricking shots, and then the Knicks obviously give up a couple of bad defensive plays, including the buzzer beater at the end of the first quarter, all of a sudden, then it felt like the momentum really shifted. The Knicks never got it back at any point in the game. And that was scary to watch if you're a Knicks fan, because 2 days off coming home, maybe that could flip the momentum, but I really hope it does. I think Tom Thibodeau is going to have to be a lot more aggressive with his bench use, whether it's Obi, whether it's Quickley. He's going to have to be, he's going to have to control this game. He can't let this game three get out of hand the way game two did, because the Knicks really never got it back at that point. Now, for the Cavs, obviously, they had a few very specific things they were trying to do. First of all, the physicality. I didn't think they were that physical. After the game, they talked about, oh, yeah, see, we're tough, because they were insulted that in game one, everyone talked about how much more physical the Knicks were. So they tried to be physical. Jared Allen had that late hit on Julius Randle, who shouldn't have been in the game at that point. But the point is, I think it was more fake tough guy, you know, toughness and physicality than actual real effective toughness. And so I don't think that's going to continue to go the Cavs' way. I think it's easy when you're winning a game by 30 points and your opponent isn't hitting any shots and your second or third best player on the team is going off the way Garland did. It's easy to be tough at the end of that game, but I don't think they're actually more tough. I think the Knicks, especially Randall's probably like, okay, you want to be tough. Let's see. And that doesn't mean Randall should get in his head and, you know, shoot his way out of the game. I think Randall needs to stay within himself, but I trust him, Johnny Bryant, the work they do, that he will. They also, after the game, the Cavs like take this team picture together and they post it on social media like they won a championship. Like, you guys are split 1-1 after two games. Like, what are you getting so excited about? For them, the positives, obviously, Donovan Mitchell, he's not going to score 17 points again in a game. He's going to have more than 20 points every game the rest of the series. I can guarantee that. He scored 17 points. He's going to come out with his head on fire at Madison Square Garden, but that might not be a great thing for him. I thought his 13 assists in game two were more important and more impactful for his team than his 38 points in game one. He answered my question. My question after last episode was, can he play a more team game? His individual play was incredible, but it might have been hurting the team. And he found a way to change the way he plays. And credit to Bickerstaff. I also asked, is Bickerstaff an idiot? He's not. He's a really good head coach. The adjustments they made with sending a second guy at Jalen Brunson, that was huge. Obviously, getting everyone else involved and getting Mitchell, you know, moving the ball to his teammates and not playing as much one-on-one. Look what it did for Garland. Look what it did for Mobley. And also using the bench, understanding that he can't lean on such heavy minutes. He made an emphasis bringing Danny Green, 90-year-old Danny Green. It really makes me happy that they don't have Kevin Love. I'm going to keep saying this in the series because they clearly want to make an emphasis of trying to find more something out of the guys on the bench. And LeVert and Danny Green were a lot better in game two. I don't think they can sustain that for a seven-game series, but if they could do that for two or three of the next five games, that could be huge for Cleveland. But this is the fun part of a series because Bickerstaff made the adjustments to game one. Now, Tibbs, it's your chess move. It's your opportunity. That's why seven-game series, especially the 4-5 matchup, which likely is going to go to seven, it's a chess match back and forth, and now it's Tibbs' move to make a move. You're up. And let's see if Tibbs can adjust. And the adjustments I think Tibbs can make, the real adjustments, obviously trying to figure out more stuff, more movement off ball, more movement without the ball, and also trying to figure out another guy who can make stuff happen for you who's not named Jalen Brunson. So it's going to be a fun series. It's 1-1 right now, headed back to Madison Square Garden. And I'll take it, honestly. Like, if you told me before the series you're going to be tied at one, you split the first two games on the road, that's always what you want if you're the road team in a series. You won back home court. But there are two ways to look at this. There's always a lot of ways to look at this, and I talk about this all the time. You could have easily lost both games, right? The first way to look at it, you could have easily lost both games, and you got blown out in game two. So you're lucky you're in this position. Like, if Josh Hart doesn't hit a miraculous three, if you don't get a couple of huge offensive rebounds, then all of a sudden you're looking at being down 2-0 in an ugly fashion. So that could just continue, and this could be really bad for the Knicks. Why do you have the confidence that all of a sudden they're going to play better over the next few games? Maybe they just lose the next three games and lose the series in five, or maybe they win another game but lose the series in six. How are you so confident? How could you be confident after the way how badly those two games looked? And the other side of it is, as bad as it looked in the first two games, you're still 1-1. Like, that's a positive thing. They have to be a lot better, no doubt. The Knicks have to be much better if they want to win this series. But you have RJ Barrett. You have Emmanuel Quickley. You have Quentin Grimes. You have Julius Randle. None of those guys have played to their capabilities yet. I don't think Mitchell Robinson has had his fingerprints or his impact on this series yet. There's a lot of guys still on this team. And even Jalen Brunson. Game one, you had parts of Jalen Brunson. He'll figure out game two. Okay, game two was a tough game for him. They game planned, they blitzed him. They game planned to stop him. He'll figure it out. He'll make an adjustment. He's a great player. He really is a great player. So you have all these other things that can still happen for you that can change. And don't worry, it's 1-1 now. If you make the adjustments and play your best basketball, because you haven't played even close to your best basketball yet, and now you're going home and you get an opportunity in front of a home crowd where you could start shooting the ball better, all these things. All those things can be better long-term for the Knicks. I think that's a really good positive from this for the Knicks. Now, another couple things. I don't think they're going to shoot 35% from the field again, especially at home. They'll knock down their shots. They'll knock down their threes, which is going to be important. They're not going to have sort of 17 turnovers again. That was just uncharacteristic. I know, give Cleveland credit. Cleveland was great on defense. That's what leads to shooting 35%. It's what leads to having 17 turnovers. But at the same time, the Knicks are a better team than that. I don't think that's going to happen again. All right, I'm excited for playoffs at the Garden. It starts tonight, one way or another. I was just watching those videos. I think I posted on my Instagram story, the defense. And this is going to be a capacity crowd. In 2021, remember, there were some mass section, all mass sections, but some of them were empty sections for people who were not vaccinated that had to wear a mask. And there were or people who wanted to sit still separate from other people. So it wasn't a capacity crowd. This is going to be the first time that it's going to be a full standing room only capacity crowd at Madison Square Garden for playoffs in about 10 years. So I'm excited for it one way or another, whether they win or lose. I hope they win these games. I hope they win the series, but I'm excited for tonight at Madison Square Garden. Let's talk about a couple of the other series. I want to start with last night, Phoenix and the Clippers. Game two was the Chris Paul versus Scott Foster game. It's actually really crazy that prior to game two, Scott Foster was 14-0 in games against Chris Paul. Now, it's funny the way I say it, but no, Chris Paul had never won a game officiated by Scott Foster. 14 games. That's a really large sample size. And it looked like, again, the Clippers were going to find a way to win this game. Kevin Durant, everyone's talking about the assist, and I talked about this in game one, and how the assists are such a positive thing for him. Are they really such a positive thing? Or do you want Kevin Durant, one of the most gifted generational players of this generation, to be assertive? Like, you want him to be assertive. And he's not been assertive enough in this series at all, and passing it off, even if he's picking up assists on it. You want KD to take those big shots for your team, and it seems like he's not involving himself enough. Chris Paul was incredible down the stretch. And it's really funny because it's been like Russell Westbrook and Kawhi Leonard against Chris Paul. And Chris Paul did an incredible job. It was like he overcame his demons and he beat Scott Foster in game two. Then game three happens and it's announced that Kawhi's not going to play in game three. And I'm thinking to myself, oh boy, this is going to be bad for them. They're not going to be close in this game. They're not going to be competitive without Kawhi Leonard, without Paul George. And I was wrong. They went in the fourth quarter, they go with this super small lineup, and they gave up a million offensive rebounds, but they were down 10 and they cut it all the way to 3. And I was like, you got to put a center, you got to put someone in there. But essentially, Russell Westbrook is playing so well right now, and this is a positive about Westbrook, that you can bench him, but you can't play him with a center because everything collapses on him. So you had to play this really super small lineup, and maybe they found something here where if you replace one of those guys, keep Man out there, but you replace one of those guys with Kawhi Leonard, all of a sudden this lineup's actually really effective because there was nothing that Phoenix could do on the defensive end to stop them. Now, defensively, it looked awful. For the Clippers, they gave up 1,000 offensive rebounds. How many layups did they give up right at the rim, specifically to Devin Booker, who was just getting right to the rim and laying it up, and he had, 44 points in the game? Because there was just no one to stop him, right? There was nobody, there was no big body at the rim. But maybe if Kawhi Leonard's kind of like your big man, that changes everything, what they're able to do. Another thing they did was they were blitzing KD and Booker. Every time they touched the ball, they were sending two at them. And it was so cool. They're like, make someone else beat us. And Chris Paul was ultimately the one who was wide open for so many shots and missed every single one of them, just bricking them one after the other. And at some point, I'm thinking game one was awful for Chris Paul. Game three was awful for Chris Paul. At some point during this series, during these playoffs, if it continues to look this bad for Chris Paul, do you have to bench him for just a shooter? If teams are going to start to do this and watch what Tyronn Lue did and leave Chris Paul wide open and say, and dare him to shoot, do you have to bench him for a shooter? That would be a really sad turn to what was an incredible career for Chris Paul, but he's just not that guy anymore, and it was kind of sad to watch. But like I said, Tyronn Lue, got to give him credit. He stuck with the small lineup even after all the layups, even after all the offensive rebounds, because on the other end, you couldn't take Westbrook out because of how valuable he's been, but you can't play him in the center at the same time. There's just not enough spacing, not enough shooting because he can't shoot. That's not his game, and that's not a knock on him. It's just not who he is, and he was exceptional in this game. And still, with all that, like, Tyronn Lue stuck with it, and it was a coaching masterpiece by him, masterclass, because he stuck with it and wasn't moved by any of these ebbs and flows. At the end of the day, they cut it to a three-point game, and Bones Highland had a three that was halfway down. Someone else had a three that was halfway down. And if it's not for a Torrey Craig three, like, he hits that three off great movement. Torrey Craig, who's had the worst plus-minus of the Clippers this entire season, they mentioned on the broadcast. If he doesn't hit that three, this game looks a lot different. If a couple of those threes that they missed The Clippers missed the toilet bowl. They went halfway down and came out, go in. Then this game looks a lot different. And also a foul. There was a foul, obviously, that could have been called on Russell Westbrook at one point against Devin Booker that wasn't called. Westbrook was upset. But if those things go the other way, we're talking about an entirely different basketball game. And so, like I said, give credit to the players, give credit to Russell Westbrook, and give credit to Bones Highland and all those guys, but real credit to Tyronn Lue for that game plan. And hopefully now, without Paul George, without Kawhi, you were able to make it that close of a game against the Suns. Can game four Saturday afternoon, can Kawhi come back and be effective in that game? We don't know. It's always a mysterious injury with Kawhi. This is always what we talk about. Kawhi, right? Like, it's incredible. He's been the best player, best two-way player in these playoffs. He's so amazing. He reminds you of how amazing he is. And then he's mysteriously hurt or injured or out. Nobody knows. That's always the what if with Kawhi. How concerned are you if you're Phoenix? Like, is this a long-term thing? Let's say you get out of this series, but you almost lost this game. And maybe they've unlocked a way to beat you, which is let Ayton shoot. Let Ayton do whatever he wants. It doesn't matter. We don't care. We won't put a big man out there. We're not scared of Ayton. Let Chris Paul shoot. Let Chris Paul get wide open. We don't care. Make Torrey Craig hit big shots. When you're facing teams that are better, there are teams in the West that are better, obviously, than the Clippers without their two best players, the Clippers without Paul George and Kawhi Leonard. When you're facing those teams, who's going to step up if they're blitzing KD and Booker the whole time? Who else is there left on this team? Is that concerning for Phoenix? Will they just figure it out because they're a great team and they'll be able to skid by just enough until they really start to gel together as the playoffs go on? Or will the clock beat them? Will they get eliminated? And the alternative is at any point, Kevin Durant could just get hurt and then everything just like that is over for them. So it's going to be an interesting story to watch for Phoenix. For Sacramento and Golden State, they played game three as well. It was must win for Steph Curry. They can't win on the road. That's the bottom line. If you're Golden State, they can't win on the road, but they come home after being down 0-2 and with no Draymond Green. And here's my thing about Draymond Green. Yes, he punched someone in the balls. He's a reaper where he stomped on someone this time. It was actually Harden who punched someone in the balls this time, but he's a repeat offender. He's done this before. I think his reaction, he showed zero remorse. Like, he's jumping up on the bench and calling the fans names and yelling at the crowd. Like, if he showed a little bit of remorse, maybe they wouldn't have suspended him, but they suspend him. Now, all that said, I think it's terrible what he does. He's a repeat offender. He doesn't care. I get that in the heat of the moment. I've never been in a competitive moment like that where I feel like I need to step on someone. But in the heat of the moment, he felt that way. And so I don't fault him for being competitive, but at the same time, you have to control yourself. He was unable to control himself, and it led to a big mistake. All that said, I don't think he should have been suspended. I think you give him, I don't know, an 8-game suspension to start next season and fine him $50,000 and say, okay, that's what it is. But you can't ruin a playoff series, potentially, by benching him for a game, by kicking him out of a game. Ultimately, it doesn't ruin this series because they win the game because Steph Curry was not going to let his team go down 0-3. Steph Curry in his career had never been down 0-2 in a playoff series. So he hasn't really, if you think about it, all their championships that they've won, there was never any real adversity being down 0-2 in a series. Of course, they do lose a series that they were up 3-1 in, so I don't know. But Steph Curry, for the first time, was down 0-2, and he did exactly what you expect a guy like Steph Curry to do. He came out and had just a masterful, masterful performance. I bet all the overs. I bet over on his threes. I bet over on his points, and I bet the Warriors to win because I knew he would have a performance like that. I cashed my bet. Thank you very much. That was a great parlay. It was about plus 330 or something like that. And it's just one of those Steph Curry masterclasses. And look, they looked lost out there. The Kings did. They looked like, oh my God, what did we get caught up in middle? That's normal. That's going to happen with a young team. Their first time in the playoffs, their first experience like this. And who knows how shaken up Sabonis was because he wasn't as good. But I think that's okay. Like, that's okay that they had this game. I think they could come back in game four and regroup. They're still the better team in this series. But like I said, this is going to be a fun series. This might be a series where, you know, they win game four, the Warriors do, and then it's back, going back to Sacramento, tie 2-2. This could be a really fun series. One thing I did want to correct, because I said Draymond contributes nothing offensively last episode. I'm wrong. Draymond Green does contribute a lot offensively. That's far from true. He's awesome. Moving without the ball, his screening, his cutting, his passing, his picks, everything he does on the offense, which is an offense. It's not just shooting 30 footers. It's the constant movement of that offense. Everything all those guys do, Draymond Green is a major part of it. Now, I will say, as far as scoring the ball, he does have a little bit of the Ben Simmons reluctance to shoot at this point in his career. You forget that in a game 7 against the Cavs in 2016 that they lost, he had 30 points and knocked down like 4 threes in that game. That game would have been a blowout if not for him. So you forget that that happens. But yes, Draymond Green, he's not that player anymore offensively when it comes to scoring the ball, but he still does a lot for them. And one last thing that I said on the episode I forgot to mention, I talked about how much fun the series is going to be because of the home crowd in Sacramento. But one guy I forgot to mention is De'Aaron Fox and how awesome he's been in this series. He's been unstoppable. He's been unafraid of the moment. He's been in takeover mode. His drives to the rim, no one can stop. And he does this thing where he's driving. It looks like it's full steam ahead to the rim. And then he just stops on a dime and pulls up for a mid-range jumper, three-pointers. Everything he's been doing has been awesome in this series. I said I hate the term him, but I hate when it's used in vain on random people because people like De'Aaron Fox need to be reserved for that term. That term needs to be reserved for them. He is him. De'Aaron Fox is awesome. A couple other series to get to. Mostly the West. We're not even talking about the East that much. Because if you think about it, Boston, I mean, they've made it look easy and now their path is going to be super easy. Like, how's Philly having a hard time with Brooklyn? I don't even want to talk about that series because I hate Brooklyn. I hate Philly. And Harden and Embiid should have been thrown out of that game. And Philly should have lost that game. But Brooklyn somehow gives it away anyway. I think Harden getting thrown out was a makeup call for Embiid not getting thrown out because he should have gotten thrown out. And this is why, like, you talk about the bias against Embiid. You're not allowed to say anything bad about him. Like, he should have been thrown out of that game. He shouldn't be the MVP. But the league is, for some reason, if you complain enough, this is the truth in the NBA, if you complain enough, you'll get protected by the league. And he complained about not being the MVP. He would have complained if he would have gotten thrown out of that game. So now he can't get thrown out of that game either. Just typical Joel Embiid. I don't want to talk about this series. I don't love that series. But Philly doesn't look that great. So if Boston's making an easy cooking of Atlanta and, you know, Trae Young. So if Boston gets to play against Philly, that could be pretty easy for Boston. I'm not even kidding. That could be an easy series for Boston the way Philly is making Brooklyn look the last couple of games. After game one, I was really impressed with Philly. I haven't been as impressed with them since. And then on the other side, you have Milwaukee who's beaten up, but Milwaukee dominates without Giannis, right? Against Miami in game two. So that's huge. We'll see where that series goes as the scene shifts to Miami. But getting back to the two other Western Conference playoff series, as that's my full Eastern Conference outside of the Knicks soliloquy. In Denver and Minnesota, the only thing I'm confused about is what happened in Denver in the third quarter. Like, what happened to them? Like, it's almost like they let up. They had a big lead in that game. They ultimately come back and win the game because they're the better team and they should win the game. But they overcome 27 second half points for Anthony Edwards, who had 40 points in the game. He's awesome. He can go off at any point. He's so great. I can't wait to see a real good team around him, but I just don't know if we'll ever see it because they seem to be incompetent, the Timberwolves. And this is just reminds you, every playoff series, Karl-Anthony Towns just looks small at times. He just doesn't look like he knows what he wants to do on the offensive side of the ball. And it can be extremely frustrating to watch at times. And Gobert is Gobert. We don't need to talk about him. The NBA is just not played for a player like Rudy Gobert anymore. He's effective. He's helping the team. I can't say he's hurting the team. It just sometimes it's frustrating to watch offensively, especially when you have two big men like that out there. I don't know why anyone thought that was going to work. The other side is Jamal Murray. Jamal Murray had 40 points in this game. And much like Klay Thompson, what we talked about in last episode, where can Klay Thompson come all the way back? If Jamal Murray can figure out a way to come all the way back to what he was a couple of years ago, at some point he gets his rhythm throughout these playoffs, that's going to be huge to have a second guy on this team, because all of a sudden, then that opens up Aaron Gordon, it opens up a little bit Michael Porter Jr., and all of a sudden, you instead of it being Jokic and a bunch of side pieces, it's Jokic, Murray, and a bunch of really talented role players. That could end up being huge in this series. So if Jamal Murray, I don't expect him to do it every game. We talked about this with Thompson. Thompson's going to have those games once in a while where he's going to pop off and you remember that he's Klay Thompson. Everyone's like, oh, Klay's back. And I get it because everyone loves Klay and I love Klay too. And he's an easy guy to root for. He's not back. He's never going to be that guy again, it doesn't seem like. But Jamal Murray's younger than him. I think he can still be that guy. So I don't want to overreact to this game and be like, oh, Jamal Murray's back. I don't want to do that. But if I can start to see this consistently over the next few games as the playoffs move on, that could be huge for Denver trying to get out of the Western Conference. The other Western Conference series is the Lakers and Memphis, which every day as it passes and I watch these, I mean, if Phoenix is this bad and the Clippers have injuries and Denver almost lost to Minnesota in that game and Memphis is now split 1-1, can the Lakers get out of the Western Conference? I think so, right? Like, that's not crazy to think that they get a few really great games from Davis. If their role players are playing the way they've been playing and LeBron, at some point when he starts to smell it and is like, oh my God, this team might actually be good. And he turns it on, turns into LeBron mode. This team could definitely get out of the Western Conference. So game two was a huge must-win game for Memphis. They win it without Ja, their best player, which has become a trend that they win a lot of games without Ja Morant. I know it was a trend last year. It's a trend this year. I wonder if it's a little bit of the Donovan Mitchell thing that we talked about after game one, where with Ja, it's like, okay, Ja, do something. And they become one-dimensional, whereas they are more of a team, well-rounded team game without him. That said, I would still much rather have Ja in every game than not have him, because he is that amazing that you could just give him the ball and be like, all right, Ja, bail us out, do something. And then after the game, Dylan Brooks is like, yeah, we're not scared of them. We're tough. Dude, what are you talking about? LeBron's not that guy anymore. What? Like, I get it. Some people need to say certain things to motivate them, but why would you want to put some bulletin board material up for LeBron James to now have a target on your back? You're 1-1 after two games at home, going on the road 1-1 with your best player injured. Is that really the time to wake up the sleeping beast that is LeBron James? Because LeBron James has not done anything yet in the series. You're right. He's kind of been passive. I talked about it after game one. He wasn't that much more aggressive in game two. So why wake him up and be like, oh, here, motivation, free motivation, LeBron, come take it. And turn him into the guy that you don't want him to be. I don't understand why any team would do that, and specifically Dylan Brooks. So I'm thinking, bet all the overs for LeBron James in Game 3. It's going to be an all-time LeBron game in Game 3. That's my gambling advice. I don't take any responsibility. All right. That is the NBA playoffs. So we still have hockey playoffs, and I want to talk about them for a little bit. And then we will wrap up. So I work for NHL Network officially, and I know I'm not allowed to talk about baseball because I'm not an on-air talent for Major League Baseball, but I am an employee, so I'm privy to certain information, but I also represent them, and they don't want people who they don't want representing them, meaning I'm not hired to talk about baseball. They don't want people like that talking about baseball because they don't want it to look at like a representation of their image. Now, the NHL has the same thing, but I don't technically work for the NHL. I work for their network. So here's a little disclaimer. I can't not talk about my Rangers as they're in the playoffs and playing this well. So I'm going to talk about the Rangers. But I am by no way a representation of the NHL Network or the National Hockey League or any of their opinions or whatever. I am my own independent thinker and talker. There's the disclaimer in case I need it for work. That's the disclaimer for you. Now let's talk some Rangers hockey. I had some pregame notes. I want to read those because I'm so happy this guy did this. I don't know him, but he's someone who DM'd me on, let me find it. He DM'd me on Instagram and he said, what do you think the keys are going to be to a win in this series for both sides? And first we were talking about it back and forth. I said, I'm confident in the Rangers. I'm scared of the Devils. I've been pretty transparent about that I'm pretty scared of the Devils. But I talked about what I think the keys, and they kind of mirror each other, what the keys would be for the series. And I mentioned things controlling the pace. I thought the Devils' pace, especially against the Rangers this year, the Rangers couldn't keep up with them. They're really fast. They're young. They're quick. They love to move quickly. They love to move fast. And I said, if the Rangers can control the pace by being physical, by hitting the Devils, not letting them get through, being aggressive on them, coming out on them, that would be huge for the Rangers. Number two, I said the second biggest thing is special teams. The Rangers can stay out of the penalty box, but also kill power plays, which, you know, the Devils' power play is essentially Q's and nothing. If the Rangers can do that, that would be huge. And then on the other side, the Rangers need to capitalize when they have their power plays. Their power play, since they brought over Kane and Tarasenko, they're still trying to shuffle the lines, figure out what works. Can they find something in that? And we'll obviously get into it. It's funny, and I wrote these before the series started. It sounds like I wrote these things. after the two games based on how the two games went. That's what's so crazy. I was spot on. I got to give myself a ton of credit. The other thing, number three I wrote was the top guys. Can Kane, Mika, these are the names I wrote. Kane, Mika, Vlad, Brett, and Kreider need to score. Can they score? Can they contribute? Can you rely on the top guys to be the big contributors in the series? And number four was Igor Shesterkin. And on the other side, I wrote, control the pace for the Devils. And 1A was Vanecek. I thought it's so important that Vanecek needs to be a huge part. He could just lose a series on his own for the Devils because I don't think he's that good. The penalty kill, I wrote for the Devils. Their penalty kill has to step up. And I said their young guys need to step up and not be intimidated. I said I was a little bit scared, though, because, you know, last year we saw the Rangers were the young team. They were the team that went down against Malkin and Crosby and all those guys and Letang and Gensel and all those guys with all that experience. And the Rangers were the team that went down against them, and they weren't intimidated at all because it was just young and dumb. The kid line led the way for the Rangers last year. So I said, this year that could be the Devils. But so far what we've seen, I mean, is everything I just talked about. The Rangers have dominated on the power play, right? The first game, the Devils were 0 for 4 on the penalty, on their own power play, and they didn't even get a shot on goal on any of the power plays. The Rangers were so aggressive with blocking pucks, with jumping out on them, with sticks in the lane. Guys like Goodrow and guys like Tyler Mott, those two guys have been huge. Obviously, also Ryan Lindgren and even Mika on the defensive side have been so good in this series. And then the big names. Tarasenko scores the first goal in each one of the two games, and Chris Kreider has four goals in two games. And Igor Shesterkin right now looks as confident as I've seen him. The Rangers haven't given up more than three goals in 20-something games. And the first two games, the first game, game one, I said to this to a bunch of my Devils fans after game one, I said, look, the Devils didn't play that bad. I don't think they're going to go 0 for 4 on the power play again. They're going to get more opportunities on the power play and they'll be able to convert. And the other thing is, I don't think that the second period was really indicative of what actually happened in the second period. In the second period, Igor stood on his head and the Rangers made a couple of huge defensive plays. But the entire second period of game one, the Devils controlled the pace. And then game two happened. And in game two, even after the first period where the Rangers were down 1-0, it felt like the Rangers dominated that period. They controlled the pace. They controlled everything that was happening. They had the puck. And a little bit at the end of that, after that power play and the power play goal, the Devils got their pace back a little bit for the rest of the first period. But that was it. From the second period and on, and really most of that first period, the first 15 minutes of that first period, the Rangers dominated that game. And I saw a team at the end of game one that looked demoralized in the Devils. Chris Kreider, like I said, four goals. The Patrick Kane goal was incredible. And the one thing I kept saying to people, I'm like, this is without the kid line. The kid line was the best 5-on-5 line for the Rangers last year in the playoffs. And it was the best 5-on-5 line this year in the first two games of the playoffs. The only thing is they've barely been out there because there have been so many penalty kills and power plays. There have been so many penalties in this game, so much special teams. So a lot of it was going to fall on special teams. A lot of it was going to fall on Igor, and it has. But I haven't seen the Rangers play as good of a game the way they played in game two in a really long time. There's their best game of the season, maybe the best game in the last 2 years, including all those really fun, great playoff games that they played last year. Now, that said, it doesn't mean anything. I think, look, the Rangers went up 2-0, and the only series they lost last year was the series they went up 2-0 in, right? Last year, they went up 2-0 against Tampa, and that was the only series they lost. Every other series, they won. Now, it wasn't as dominant of a 2-0, but it was pretty dominant. They were up 2-0 in that series. Now, granted, also, it was at home. The Rangers won two games at home and then didn't win another game the rest of the series. But I think, just like the Rangers went into New Jersey and were able to win two games, I think the Devils can definitely go into Madison Square Garden. I think Lindy Ruff's going to be like, hey, you guys are young and dumb. Don't sweat it. Just play free. Get out of your own heads. You know, don't be intimidated. Just go out there and go crazy at Madison Square Garden on the world's biggest stage. I still think this is a real series. It's far, far, far from over. Don't get me wrong. But the Rangers in the series have looked incredible so far. Now, after game one, what was so interesting was what Chris Kreider said. Chris Kreider, after game one, they asked him. He became the all-time Rangers leading goal scorer in the playoffs with two goals in game one. And they asked him and he said, well, we won game one. That's the important thing. When I asked him a personal question, he said, we won game one. That's the important thing. We celebrated for 5 minutes and now it's on to game two. Everyone knows game two is the toughest game to win in a series. And then after game two, they say, well, Chris, you said game two is the toughest game to win in a series. You won game two and you had two more goals in the series. He said, well, my teammates put me in a good position and I was just lucky enough to, you know, be in the right position to finish the plays. But it's all my teammates who actually made the plays. And I actually think game three is the most important game in a series. So we're focused on game three. We're happy we won game two. We'll celebrate for 5 minutes. We're happy we're on to game three right now. That guy is perfect. He's my favorite athlete. He's Derek Jeter. He's everything. Like, there's never going to be an athlete in my life again. I always say this. That's Derek Jeter to me. But Chris Kreider is the closest thing to that guy. I love that guy. 4 goals in 2 games. I hope he can keep it up somewhat. Because this team, I always say this, that my favorite Rangers team was the team after they went to the Cup, the team that lost in the conference finals to Tampa. And then I think last year's team really won me over, and I was so just demoralized when they lost. And I watched that video again of Chris and Mika talking about afterwards, like how they lost the series, and talking about like that they just don't want it to be over, that every other night for so many days in a row they were playing and it was so much fun and they just don't want it to be over. And that was how I felt after that series. And I watched that video again today because I wanted to remind myself to, okay, we're up 2-0. Enjoy this right now. Who knows how many more of these you're going to get. Just enjoy these playoffs. So, you know, Bob O'Reilly up 2-0 at Madison Square Garden on Saturday night is going to be crazy. The crowd's going to be nuts. And just every Ranger fan should not forget to enjoy it. Tarasenko, you knew when they got him. He's a 16-game player. He's a playoff player. He could finish. He can skate. He's tough. He's physical. He's awesome. He's so perfect for this team. I'm so happy there's finally a guy on that line with Panarin who just compliments him so well. And those two guys, it's going to be so much fun to watch them as the playoffs go on. But there's still a long way to go. If Igor's playing like this, they can beat anyone. Somebody asked me if I'm afraid of Boston. I said, I'm not afraid of Boston. If Igor's playing like this, I'm not afraid of Boston, because we have Igor, you don't. That's the line. But it's been fun so far. So that's it. That's what's going on. Playoffs, both playoffs, Rangers. It's been fun. The Knicks, I just hope they can get out of this first round. Obviously, the Rangers have greater aspirations. And I hope between the two teams, I can get to a game. I really want to go to a Knicks playoff game. Maybe I should start a GoFundMe, but I really want to go to a Knicks playoff game at some point. Just see that team in the playoffs. It'll be just such an incredible feeling. But until next time, I will talk to you guys on an upcoming episode. So stay tuned. Thank you all for listening. As always, let's go Knicks. Let's go Rangers. Keep enjoying the NBA playoffs and keep it locked right here. I hope to record as much as possible with my busy schedule. Hopefully I'll record hopefully after game three of each of those series. Game three is tonight, Friday night for the Knicks and Saturday night for the Rangers. Hopefully after those games on Sunday at some point, I can find time to record and post an episode. But until then, like it, subscribe, share it with a friend if you can. I appreciate it. And as always, see ya. You were the best nights of my life. You got the light that always shines. I miss the way that you move and the way I get high when you take me to your heights, like I'm standing in the sky. I see your subway cars and road graffiti. I breathe your air when I land in another city. I'll be that one that's got you printed on my bones. Yeah, you're all I know. Everywhere I go, oh, oh, I change it all. Oh, oh, always on my road, I'm still New York. Drive down Riverside, see the birds flying on the high line. With the sidewalks burning, we pray for rain in July. I want the Yankees 99, yeah, and the Knicks, yeah, on a sold out night. When the curtains close and the Broadway streets are alive, hey. I need your heartbeat close, don't you ever leave me. And I breathe your air when I land in another city. And I'll be that one that's got you printed on my bones. Yeah, you're all I know. Everywhere I go, oh, oh, I change it all. Oh, oh, always on my road, I'm still New York. You're the only that I'll ever know. My concrete walls, I'm still New York. Yeah, BK born and raised.
days I was God sent. I used to hit them courts out in Prospect. Take them long walks on my time spent. Just a kid with that empire state of mindset. Kick flipping off a blind deck. Dipping from the New York City's finest. Yeah, said I've been up on my New York shit. Walking down the block with my New York bitch. I can never leave my city, ain't nothing like it. Even if I do though, I can never hide it. Top down on the west side when I'm driving. East side be the only side that I'm riding. And I'm still New York.
I ain't changed it all. I'm still New York.